This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. This week, some top policymakers, planners, and academics and economists gathered at the University of Utah for a conference on Africa. Africa is a dynamic and relatively young and growing continent, which is rich in natural resources and economic opportunity. The conference this week, co-sponsored by the Council of American Ambassadors and the Hinckley Institute of Politics, was designed to critically examine the continent, the arc of its economic development, and how best to invest in Africa's future. But as we've heard much about these past several months, the western coastal countries of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are struggling to contain a massive Ebola virus outbreak where tens of thousands of people have died from the disease. The first speaker we're airing today is Daniel Bosch. He's a virologist who's spent several years working on hemorrhaging fevers, such as Ebola, Marburg, and Lassa fevers, at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Bosch is an associate professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine in Louisiana. He spoke on Monday this week at the University of Utah's Spencer Fox Eccles Business Building.
Since this, I know, is not a purely medical crowd, I wanted to just give a few very basic public health and medical points, first of all, because these are important to understanding the rest of it. And there's been a lot of debate about this and a lot of, unfortunately, sometimes misinformation in the news. But first of all, Ebola virus is spread directly by blood and bodily fluids. This is not a virus that's easily spread from one person to another. You have to have direct contact with a person, usually in the later stage of illness, when they have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, sometimes bleeding. It's not spread through casual contact. It's not spread through shaking hands with a healthy person, sitting next to them in an auditorium, not during the incubation period, not through the air, not through the water. Again, direct contact, and that's why the people who are at risk of this virus are really healthcare workers who are caring for a sick person or family members who are caring for a sick person. So this is not something that's just going to be spread around in the community easily. The longest incubation period, that is the time from infection until when symptoms start, is 21 days. We use that as a very conservative estimate. Actually, the real, if we look in terms of what really happens most of the time, it's 8 to 10 days is when we see people develop symptoms. So those are the basics that you need to understand. How does this happen? How do we have Ebola outbreaks? The first one we ever had was in 1976 in the Congo, which was then named Zaire. The virus was named after a river in the Congo called Ebola. And we didn't recognize this until quite recently, but years of observation and research have shown us that bats are the reservoir for these viruses. This is not just any sort of bat, it's specific. Most of these viruses are very specific to one particular subtype of bat or species of bat. So for example, if you took Ebola virus and put this into bats in North America, you wouldn't have a colony of bats that would become infected. They're very specific, related to coevolution over many, many years between one specific virus and one specific species of an animal. So these are in fruit bats that exist in sub-Saharan Africa. You can see if you look, this here is a photo that we took inside a mine when we were trying to pin down what the reservoir was, not for Ebola actually, but for the sister virus called Marburg back in the late 90s. All those white dots are bat eyes looking back at you. So lots of bats in these mines and caves. Also pretty much where my family gave up trying to understand what I do for a living. They sort of had an idea more of kind of a, you know, white coat, blood pressure taking doctor, not a trapping bats in the Congo doctor. So this is how this happens. We have a bat that is infected with Ebola virus, and like reservoirs, of course, for pathogens, they have no obvious symptoms. They don't get sick. And humans can get infected through a couple different mechanisms. First of all, they could get infected directly by the bat. That was usually not something where there's a bat bite or they even notice a particular exposure to a bat. This could be, for example, where a bat in sub-Saharan Africa, these are fruit bats, and so they're going and perhaps feeding on mangoes, and then maybe the guano, the feces of that bat that's infected with Ebola virus, fell on another mango that a child or a human could eat and unbeknownst to them get infected. So most of the time, people wouldn't know that they had any particular exposure. And then The other way that this can happen is rather than the human eating the mango, as an example, that maybe another animal, a chimp or a monkey or a gorilla, could eat that mango and get sick. And as you all recognize, that bush meat is a very common source of protein in many areas of the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. And so when humans go out and hunt this chimp or monkey, and you can imagine that the chimp or monkey that has a touch of Ebola might be a little slower that day, easier to hunt and to catch. And so they get exposed when they're not eating, but butchering, and get exposed to the blood and body fluids of that animal. This is a very easy virus, actually, to kill once it gets into the environment. It can be inactivated by bleach and alcohol and cooking. So, for example, someone who ate the meal of a non-human primate, even if that was Ebola-infected in the beginning, that would not be dangerous for them. For cooking the meat would inactivate the virus. So it's the person who's getting the direct exposure to blood and bodily fluids. So during an outbreak, we think that this happens where a human gets infected really just one time. This is a very rare event, and occasionally this will happen in different places in sub-Saharan Africa. And then what happens after that? Everything, when we have a large outbreak, if we have, let's say, 10,000 cases of Ebola in West Africa right now, we have this that happened one time. And then after that, the other 9,999 all represent human-to-human transmission. And so that's our real problem. Whereas it might be a good time to maybe not have the bat soup or not go out and catch bats and not have exposure to non-human primates, there are lots of other reasons to avoid bushmeat, although it's a significant source of protein, a more controversial issue if we really got into it. But nevertheless, that's really not what's going to stop an Ebola outbreak. It's all person-to-person transmission that we need to deal with. And this is indeed what happened in this sort of very rural area, an area called Gekidu in the country of Guinea. I'll show you in a map in a minute. It just so happens, incidentally, that I've been working in this area of West Africa in Guinea and Sierra Leone and to some extent Liberia for the last 15 years or so, not on Ebola projects, but on projects on Lassa fever, a related hemorrhagic fever virus that's endemic in the area. So happened to be an area that I know very well. And so usually this happens in a pretty rural area like this. And you can see, you know, this family here that we went to visit, actually, and not easy to get to many of these places. I was going out there to find this little girl who was exposed. Her mother had Ebola, and we worried about her also being a case. Fortunately, she did not have Ebola, but these are pretty rustic rural environments, typically. This is on the map here where things started. Gekidu is in this region. And so typically what will happen, happened this time, it got into this rural area. We think that the first case was a two-year-old boy who, we speculate, got a mango or whatever fruit that it might have been that infected him. And then he'll get sick and a family member will take care of him, probably his mother. She gets exposed to the infected blood and bodily fluids. She falls sick. Perhaps her sister takes care of her. It bounces around like that. You've probably heard that one of the things that often happens in this setting is that people attend funerals, and a custom that's very frequent in sub-Saharan at funerals is there's a lot of touching of the corpse, sometimes directly touching the corpse. In some places, there's a tradition of washing the corpse with water, but you collect that water, and then people would go and bathe a little bit in that water. And so you can imagine if that person died of Ebola, that there would be a lot of infectious virus in that sort of contact. And so we see frequently that we'll have people attend a funeral, and then 8 or 10 days later, numerous people who attended and touched the corpse will get sick. So that's what we had happen here in Gekidu. And ironically, there's probably not infrequently introductions of Ebola in sub-Saharan Africa that don't cause large outbreaks. They cause small outbreaks. Someone goes into the forest, perhaps hunts a non-human primate, gets exposed themselves during the butchering. There's a hunting team that comes back. Somebody gets sick. The wife, perhaps, of that hunter takes care of him. She gets sick. Her sister takes care of her. And then everyone recognizes that something terrible is going on. Naturally, they would do what we would all do. We say, okay, well, maybe we won't go visit right now in that compound, that household. And so we have a small tragedy where perhaps 8 or 10 people in a given compound get sick and die, but that's the end of it. Then the virus becomes extinct in that particular chain of transmission. And that's it. No one ever knows about Ebola. They never heard about Ebola. They may attribute it to poisoning or sorcery or many different things. What ironically changes that small event to a large outbreak, one of the major factors that underlies all large outbreaks of Ebola or Marburg hemorrhagic fever, is ironically when people go to healthcare centers. And so over the last few decades, or probably more than that, maybe 40 years, but people, well-meaning groups have decided in West Africa, we need to provide care. We need to develop hospitals, clinics, and things like that. And so, of course, they do that, and that's a good thing. But what they find is that it's much easier to create the initial infrastructure than to keep that up for many years. And so a mission group, a government, an NGO, whatever it may be, they can create the four walls of a clinic, they'll set a nurse there, and for a while have a supply chain where there's some medicines coming in, and some gloves and some needles and things. And then what'll happen, people will run out of their money. In the particular cases involved here, there'll be a civil war, for example. That supply chain dries up. And so if you go back 10 years later or 15 years later, you'll still have a nurse who's out there, but really just kind of a very informal fee-for-service type of clinic without a good supply of clean gloves, without a good supply of clean needles, without really the things that we would take for granted here in the United States. And so a patient comes into that setting, is bleeding, has nausea, vomiting, diarrhea with Ebola, and that healthcare worker gets exposed. Not only do they sometimes get exposed and get disease, but they can decide, okay, well, maybe that person, who of course is not recognized to have Ebola, they say, well, let's give this person a vitamin B6 shot. So they give them a vitamin B6 shot and say, and then the person in the next bed needs a vitamin B6 shot too, but we don't have a clean needle, so we'll rinse this one out a little bit, and goes down the line. And so there's a whole bunch of people who come into the hospital not with Ebola, would come in with malaria or typhoid fever, or many other things that are much more common, but leave the hospital actually getting Ebola there and go back to the community, incubating the disease, fall sick, a family member takes care of them, fall sick, and we have that sort of what we call nosocomial amplification. And then in the worst case scenario, and we're close to the worst case scenario, we'll talk about how far we've come and need to go. But so you have someone who decides, well, I would get better care if I went to the hospital here in the capital, Conakry, a city of about 1.5 million people. And so that's what happened here. A doctor got sick, traveled up here, spent the night. This is about 600 kilometers to do this route. Takes you about 15 hours by road. And came up here, spent the night with family, ended up infecting someone there in their family, and came down here to a hospital in Conakry. But unfortunately, the same thing, where a hospital that really wasn't prepared with gloves, and it's not only gloves and needles, these are often places where we're just talking about having running water, having soap, having really just the basic necessities. And so that initiated a chain of transmission that continues to this day of going around in Conakry. And then simultaneously, people in this area of Gekidu that I showed you, this, as you can see, is an area juxtaposed with the borders of Sierra Leone and Liberia. In sub-Saharan Africa, people often affiliate much more readily than we would in the United States with their ethnic group, perhaps more than with their national group. And so if we ask most of the people in this room to describe themselves, fairly readily they would say, I'm an American, I'm from the United States. And people in sub-Saharan Africa would often do that too. But it might, the higher on the list might be that they're Kono or Kisi or Gerze or different ethnic groups that share culture and language and live on both sides of these borders, which of course don't really mean anything. These are artificial borders that were created along colonial lines. So you have ethnic groups that live on both sides. The border, there may be a road that crosses here and there. You can't really close the border. You can close the road, but you can walk down a mile and walk across. It's really not difficult. And so you'll have people who live here but go on market days on Wednesdays on the other side and go back and forth. I've been places in this area where the houses were on one side and the kids went to school on the other side of the border. So you cross quite easily. And what happened is that people started crossing, and some of them crossed, were infected with Ebola, and started spreading it first here in eastern Sierra Leone and northern part of Liberia. And then it's gone from there and gradually spread to different areas. And so we have now cases, and actually I read in the report yesterday, the one district of Sierra Leone that was free of Ebola has now also reported cases. So all across, every district of Sierra Leone now has some cases of Ebola. This is still here in the east, the most heavily affected part, and almost all of Liberia has cases. And as was mentioned early on, Governor Leavitt, it's well accepted, I think, from WHO and CDC and all of us who work in this area, that the actual number of the number of cases really far outstrips the actual reported number. So we have at least 10,000, perhaps 15,000 cases of Ebola in sub-Saharan in that area right now.
That's Daniel Bosch. He's a virologist and an associate professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He spoke on Monday at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us today, we're airing a talk given on Monday by Daniel Bosch, a virologist who's spent several years working on hemorrhagic fevers such as Ebola, Marburg, and Lassa fever in the region of West Africa that's currently besieged with a massive outbreak of Ebola virus. He spoke about his experiences to an audience of students and faculty.
So this is just to give you a feel for what things look like here in Gekidu. This is sort of downtown Gekidu, and you can get a feel, of course, that this is not a particularly developed place. This is a city, if you will, of about 120,000. There's no electricity. Life is pretty simple. You know, in Guinea, I've been going there since 1996, and what I've seen since that time is really what I would describe as de-development. Every time I would go there, the roads would be worse. The situation, prices would be higher, goods would be more scarce. It's not a situation where, you know, you kind of, we hope and expect that the default position is gradual development. This was going the opposite way, and that's probably multifactorial, but frankly speaking, one of them, of course, was poor governance, that this was a country that was governed, if you will, in quotes, by a dictator. Much of the public funds were being siphoned off for personal use. That was Lansana Kanté, who died a few years ago. So these are the sorts of environments. I apologize for these graphic photos. I always seem to be on after lunch. I don't know why that is. But this is, if you will, what I call the hot zone Ebola, or if anyone read that book, The Hot Zone, by Richard Preston, that in that book he erroneously described, honestly, Ebola as this disease where your eyeballs melt and your liver turns to mush and things like that. And actually, when I first got into this field, I often wondered, why did it take so long to figure out who had Ebola? How many cases do you need to see with their eyeballs melting to figure things out? But in fact, that's not really the reality. The reality, this is more typical. This is a woman in Uganda who has a little bit of what we call subconjunctival hemorrhage. You don't incidentally ever have blood that's leaking out of your eyes. It's just behind this clear membrane, a little bit of bleeding. She has a little bit of bleeding around the mucous membranes of the mouth, attracting a few flies. So that's more typical. But much more typical are these very, very non-specific symptoms, signs and symptoms that I don't have a picture of, because you would never take a picture. There's nothing to see. And so when people present with Ebola, especially in the early phases, they present with fever and headache and muscle aches for a few days. And then after 3 or 4 days of that, they may start in with some nausea and vomiting and diarrhea. And a minority of people actually have bleeding, and so it's very difficult to pick these cases out and distinguish the Ebola from the malaria, from the typhoid fever, from other things that are much more common. So what do we do normally? We set up something like this. This is an isolation ward at Conakry. The group Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is often one of the key groups that does this. And we set things up. The idea, of course, is that we want to set up something where we have isolation of a patient, the best treatment that we can give them. Then we'll try to find all the contacts of the patient, trace them for 21 days since their last contact. And each day, it's a very simple process on the surface, at least, trace them and say, how do you feel today? If they say, I feel fine, we say, great, we'll see you tomorrow. After 21 days, if they still say, I feel fine, we say, great, you don't have Ebola. If at any time they say, I feel like I have a headache and a fever, we say, okay, you need to come into the isolation ward. Seems like a simple process, but if you think of just what we need in each one of these places, we need to have, okay, an isolation board, we need to have surveillance teams to find cases, find contacts, we need to have vehicles and transport for them, we need to have logistics for them, we need to have a social mobilization team, we need to have a laboratory, and so each time that you have a new front where you have to create these and you say, okay, well, we can do that in Gekidu, but, oh, well, now there's cases in Conakry, okay, let's do it in Gekidu and Conakry, now in Kailahun, Sierra Leone, now in Kenema, Sierra Leone, now in Bong, County in Liberia, now in Monrovia, and how many different fronts can you open at one time? And that's one of the stories of this outbreak, is basically outstripping the resources that were easily outstripped in terms of the national resources of the countries involved, because these are the poorest countries in the world, and then also outstripping, after a few months, the international organizations involved, and then scurrying now, as we've been behind, to try to catch up and get the resources into this and implement on the ground. And so consequently, we've had settings like this. These are not how isolation wards are supposed to look. This is just what we've been doing, because we don't have any other choice. We just don't have the capacity right now. We don't want this massive thing where all these beds are together and this sort of environment, but the capacity we're really behind. So I mentioned a little bit what we usually do and the contact tracing and all these things, and then, but unfortunately, that's really not, hasn't worked this time. And for those reasons that I mentioned, the porous borders. And when you get into this situation, there's a time, and we thought we had it last April. When I came home, I guess it was the beginning of May from Guinea, there were very few cases, and we thought, okay, maybe this is wrapped up. And well, you can't have surveillance across all the, you know, the broad swaths of West Africa. And so what you do is do the best surveillance you can. And sometimes you're right, it is wrapped up. And sometimes after 10 days, somebody knocks on the door and says, we just found out about 10 people who died in some village that you've never heard of. And things go on. And it's sort of like you can't put out 99% of a forest fire, right? Unless you get all of it, you know, it still has the potential to come back. And that's what happened. And so it came back. And we've gotten into this really exponential growth in Liberia, with Sierra Leone not far behind. So why is the old system, why has it worked before and not worked now? I mentioned that these are the poorest countries on the planet, essentially. And so we've really, with the scale of this, outstripped not only their resources, but the resources initially of many other groups that would normally do this. And one of the things that people don't recognize, that even at places like CDC and WHO and MSF, there are not 500 people who do this. This is a very small group. And so you put your resources into the field, you put, you know, however many people that you have, and it's very high stress work, it's fatiguing work, and after 2 or 3 months you've kind of gone through a few rotations and say, great, like we have what we need, you know, and we should be declaring victory. And these people are tired, they come home, and then you say, oh no, we're not declaring victory this time. Now we find out that the forest fire is still raging. You go back, and well, who is there to go back? We've already exhausted much of the energy. So we have this very difficult situation. What do we need to do now? We need to do what we are doing, a massive upscaling. This is happening in many ways. It's just the logistical impediments are very extreme for this. And the parallel that I often give, we can say, okay, we need to put a man on the moon tomorrow, and it costs $7 billion, and I can say, there's the $7 billion, go. But it's still unlikely that we'll actually have a man on the moon tomorrow. There are just a lot of logistical impediments. We don't have the rocket just ready. We need to do the training. We need to ensure safety. And we don't have this capacity, is not set anywhere in the world. If this was a war, if this was a different type of natural disaster, we have people who know about that. We've done that before. In this case, we have experts, but we don't have many experts. And so it's taking a lot of time. Time that we don't really have, but we're just, we need to do it as fast as we can, and things are happening. But, and then there's some degree of travel restrictions. We can talk about that. I'm not in favor of travel restrictions in terms of trying to cut off all the travel from West Africa. One of the things that a lot of people, when this comes up, don't really realize that, first of all, there have never been in the last 20 years that I've been working on this direct flights that come from Sierra Leone, Liberia, or Guinea to the United States anyway. So there's no direct flight to cut off. When we're talking about limiting travel, we'd be talking about limiting travel from Brussels, London, and Paris to the United States. Those would be the flights that we would be stopping, of whom very few of those passengers would actually be from the epidemic area. There are many reasons not to do that as well that we don't have time to get in here. I want to end because I know I'm going over and want to leave some time for questions. This is a humanitarian crisis that's playing out in West Africa. If there's any silver lining, I think that it is pushing some of the tools that we have in terms of therapeutics, vaccines, other strategy. It's pushing them forward to give us, hopefully in real time for this outbreak, if it's not for for the next outbreak, some actual tools that we can use to really have an effect. And last couple slides. One, this is really where this battle needs to be won. I think we need to make we need to really make a strong investment in the short term and in the long term. And these people who are training here in Guinea to do surveillance for Ebola, it's not something that ultimately we need to react very aggressively as we are doing now from the United States and elsewhere. But we need to recognize that I think ultimately, you know, it's with these people that we're going to have to partner to get this done. And then I want to mention that a lot of you know that many healthcare workers have died in West Africa, and some that have come from other places as well. And I want to remember them. You know, I have to say, people like me, we get a lot of attention. There's a million media requests every day for this, but it's relatively easy for someone like me. You know, I go and I come back, and then I can rest, and then I can get back a little bit to my normal life. But for people who live in West Africa, this is every day. This is their community, their hospital, their job, their family. There's no getting out of it. And so these are really kind of the true heroes. So just to finish, take home points that I want to put in there. So first of all, this is first and foremost a West African problem. That doesn't mean that we don't need to be integrally involved in the solution, but we need to recognize, we've seen here in the last 2 weeks that with a couple cases in the United States, sure, we need to be concerned about it. We've had some missteps. We need to do better with that. But I still believe very strongly we will not have a large outbreak of Ebola virus in the United States. This is not a virus that's easily contracted here. We need, and we've had, which I think, you know, people said was a possibility, that we may have imported cases. We may have very limited secondary transmission, but really this is a West African problem, and that's where we need to act. We can't say the solution is not when there's a raging forest fire 2 miles from here to say, let's wait here with our bucket of water at the feet. We need to go there. We need to be proactive. We need to be involved. And so that's one thing I think that people need to realize, and we can't lose sight of that. That's the real solution. And the other thing I want to mention is that we need to make sure we stick to the science. I've been very perturbed over the last week a little bit by the phrase that's often out there, we're doing something out of an abundance of caution. And when I hear that, often what I really think is that means that we have no scientific data to do this, but we're going to do it anyways. And I think that's really been confusing to the American public. I think when we say, well, this virus is not easily transmitted between people, it's not transmitted between people who are not symptomatic, but we're going to put people in isolation for 21 days. What message do we take from that? I think it's very confusing. It either tells us that we don't have the science when we do have the scientific knowledge often to act, or tells people an incorrect message that we don't really know what's happening. So I think we need to make sure that we have informed public health and we have the courage to really act on the science that we have. And I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
All right, we have time for a couple of quick questions. Why don't we start over here? And
thank you for your quite informative talk. I had actually two questions. There's some modeling that suggests that in West Africa, it may peak at about 10,000 cases, 10,000 infections a week over the next couple of years. And the second point, that there's some evidence that there may be variants that are emerging that will require new research or new efforts to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Are those true observations? Or?
So there are various different models that people are looking at, and of course the models change depending upon what the response is and how successful the response is. And so ironically, in some ways, if you have no response, actually the peak can go up very rapidly, but the duration can go down. If you think about it, you know, if you just let the virus go, then after a short period of time, everyone who's going to get infected gets infected. So the numbers of cases can go down, but the duration increase if the response is more appropriate and more effective. So I think I'd have to get out the crystal ball to really tell you what's going to happen. I think that we have certainly months and months of Ebola virus outbreak to go in West Africa. Some people would say maybe we have a year. I don't know. One of the key things, one of the very important aspects that we really cannot let happen is for this to get outside of the three countries where this is. And so as you all know, we had an imported case in Nigeria some months back. Fortunately, we've been able to contain that. The same in Senegal. I think we can all imagine if this got to be really unbridled transmission in a place like near Nigeria or other places in West Africa, then we would have, you know, that's our worst case scenario. We're not quite yet there, but hopefully we won't see that. This virus, like all RNA virus, has some degree of mutations that are accumulated over time. That's to be expected. We don't know yet what those mutations mean. I think they're important to monitor. They're unlikely to, in my opinion, drastically change the nature of the virus. I think the discussion that's been out there, you know, will this virus go airborne, is much overplayed. I think that's extremely unlikely to happen. I can't think of any example, really, of a virus or a pathogen that's fundamentally changed its biology. But some of those mutations can have importance in terms of the relative lethality of the virus, the relative transmissibility of the virus, again, not changing from being contact spread to airborne, but just how easily through contact spread. And then some of the things about how well some of the diagnostics and how well some of the potential therapeutics work for this. So it's something that we do need to be monitoring.
Thank you for your talk. I would like to ask if you could shed more light about the experimental therapy that you mentioned. And in your mind, or in your predictions, how soon are we going to have a vaccine, an efficient vaccine?
Okay. Yeah, good question. We had a meeting at WHO last month, a very unusual meeting, to get together all the people who work in the field, pharmaceutical industry, FDA, regulatory industry. There were some huge gaps, in my opinion, in understanding. Some of the FDA people said, okay, we're going to, you know, do these sorts of trials in Africa where we're going to take the vital signs every 4 hours and measure the electrolytes. And I often find myself, you know, having spent a lot of time in West Africa for these outbreaks, getting up and being the spoiler a little bit and say, here's what you need to envision. You have 100 people who have Ebola. You have a doctor and two nurses. And so they're lucky if you can keep people in a bed and perhaps know what their name is rather than, you know, taking their blood pressure every 4 hours. But nevertheless, there are some opportunities there. We have two very good vaccine candidates, some others waiting in the wings and being developed. Some of those vaccines, or those two vaccines right now, are in the initial what we call phase 1 safety trials in humans to see if they look safe. If everything goes well with those trials that are being done in the United States, the UK, Mali, and Uganda, if everything looks good, we hope by the beginning of the year to have perhaps 10 or 20,000 doses of those vaccines and then ramp up the production from there. I don't think that we will probably be able to count on that technology, vaccines or therapeutics, to really get us out of this jam. I think we may get enough so that we can perhaps vaccinate the healthcare workers, and that would be a good thing to do. But if you think about the vaccines, you know, the population of this epidemic area is 22 million people, so it's unlikely we're going to have that order of magnitude to really work with in the short term. And let's put it this way, we hope that the outbreak will be over by the time we would have those numbers.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. And one of the most interesting things I've noticed about watching this whole thing unfold is how quickly the element of fear is spreading throughout, you know, the country and the world. And I think it's safe to say that if that spread as fast as the disease did, or vice versa, then we would all be in a bit of a mess, but what kind of things can public officials say and health officials say and even the media kind of say to people to keep kind of the element of fear suppressed while still, you know, understanding the gravity of the situation and holding on to what is the truth and what has been preconceived in our minds?
Right. Good question, and always a difficult one. So, you know, public health is always a challenge when you have things. You need to inform the public, and it's always a very fine line of informing the public but without having people panic, right? And the line is especially fine when we talk about Ebola. As I mentioned earlier, I think that in the last week or two, we've erred a little bit by getting away from the science. And again, my example of, you know, that abundance of caution, I don't think that really ultimately calms people down. I think that confuses them. So I think we need to be careful that we, you know, go with the science. We know that this virus is not spread, for example, in the early phase of the disease. We have those data. I think there's, you know, that's clear enough. And so when we see, and we're seeing the results of that now, if you will, that, for example, the people who were exposed to the man in Texas who ultimately died, the family members exposed very early in the course of his illness, have just passed their 21 days without contracting disease, whereas the nurses who were exposed later on when the person had nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They were also doing some fairly high risk, you know, that man was getting dialysis, he was getting intubated, procedures that are much higher risk than things that happen in the community, of course. So I think we need to be very careful and really make sure that we stick with the science and people will trust us. But I think if we get a little bit too gray there, even though it seems good to be very cautious, and, you know, it gives some very mixed messages that are dangerous.
What is happening in the rest of Africa, south, east, and north of where this problem is? Are we seeing outbreaks of one and two in different countries in Africa?
The only place outside of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea where we're seeing any Ebola right now is in the northern part of the Congo, but it's completely unrelated. When we do the sequencing and the epidemiology of that, that would be a second introduction from a bat, like I described earlier, that's happening and relatively contained. I think there's about 78 cases. The pace of that has slowed. That's a country where people are used to having Ebola outbreaks, unlike this region. So really that, I don't anticipate that is going to pose a major problem for us. Really, all the other than that, the only cases, the only places that we know of in the world right now, other than the imported cases, of course, are Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. And we really need to work hard to keep it that way. People are working hard. There's a lot of activity in the surrounding countries. There's a lot of things going on to prepare. We have to be vigilant about that, and we have to hope that those are successful.
Daniel Bosch. He's a virologist and an associate professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He spoke on Monday at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. This week, the University of Utah hosted a conference co-sponsored by the Council of American Ambassadors and the Hinckley Institute of Politics to critically examine Africa's future in the global economy. We've spent most of this show so far replaying a talk by virologist Daniel Bosch on the Ebola outbreak, but much of the conference also focused on the continent's future potential. Rosa Whitaker is the CEO and president of the Whitaker Group, a Washington, D.C.-based consultancy specializing in trade and investment in Africa. She served as assistant U.S. trade representative for Africa and the administrations of George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. She spoke largely about what can be expected of Africa in coming years. She also spoke on Monday at the Spencer Fox Eccles Business Building at the University of Utah.
Okay, so this is Imagining Africa in 2050. First, it will be a continent of 2.5 billion people, comprising 25% of the global population. It will be young, with a billion people under 18 years of age. Africa is a young and growing continent in a graying world. But by 2050, fertility rates will be dropping, leading to a larger number of productive adults supporting fewer children and elderly dependents. It's The current trends indicate that the world's largest workforce will be in Africa. This is in stark contrast to the developed world and parts of Asia, in particular China, where a declining workforce will increasingly be supporting a graying population. Younger workers will be entering the workforce, and this is aspirational, but I happen to believe it. They will be more work-ready than ever before, having benefited from the improvements in nutrition, education, job training, internet connectivity, and access to entrepreneurial opportunity. And they will be the workforce that will make most of the world's goods. We also see the GDP growth and population growth. And in 2050, we'll have a healthier, better educated, and more connected Africa. 56% of all Africans will live in cities. Subsistence agriculture will become a thing of the past as people move to cities and are employed in more productive sectors such as entrepreneurialism, manufacturing, and service activities. Africa's urban growth rate is now 3.6%, which is twice as high as the world's average. Approximately 40% of Africans currently live in urban areas. By 2030, this will climb to over 50%. Cities in Africa are projected to grow to 85% of their current size. The African middle class will exceed 1 billion people, spending more than $2 trillion on a range of consumer goods and products. And there's a growing middle class. The majority of the Africans will live, I believe this part is a bit aspirational, but some of the trends indicated, will live in stable and democratic countries and will have the leisure and education to participate vigorously in civil society and hold their leaders to a high standard of accountability. I say that because this part is aspirational, but the African Development Bank has done some good work in backing this aspiration and saying how it's possible. Infrastructure and energy sources, they have the potential to be really adequate for the continent's growing needs. Of course, this is all going to depend on some choices. African economies will be increasingly diversified and integrated into global value chains. We see that trend happening. For example, countries that produce strategic minerals will also manufacture electronic components and materials for export. I was just 2 days ago in Kigali talking to the East Africa Business Summit on how you harness Africa's natural resources for sustainable development. And it was interesting, I was talking about the Malaysian example of Penang and how they made the right choices. And Malaysia was right along the same development trajectory as many African countries. Many years ago, they made the right choices. And Penang, I'm told, looked like many African communities. But they made the right choices. They actually exploited some of those natural materials, invested in development, and so they were not, they stopped just solely exporting the raw materials and start processing electronic goods. But it's a very deliberate exercise. And that could be the trend of Africa. Locally grown cotton will increasingly supply apparel manufacturers. And Africa can be a global manufacturing hub, assembling everything from cars to computers using imported as well as locally produced components. We see these trends happening. The continent, if it continues on its pace, as some setbacks and disappointment, will have achieved strong regional integration, and intra-Africa trade will be a major driver of manufacturing. Greater regional harmonization will also mean that goods travel quickly to ports for global exports. Much of the world's food will be grown in Africa, which holds up to 60% of global uncultivated cropland. At present, 1.46 billion acres compared to 741 million acres in Latin America. With less subsistence farming, better farming practices, and good transportation networks, agricultural output could really explode. And then if we get to have better and healthy tax revenues with foreign direct investment and remittances, I believe that most African governments will have graduated and can graduate from dependence on aid, able to fund their country's budgetary needs and raise more money on global capital markets. While there will probably be some African countries that still need foreign aid, I believe that most by 2050 can be and will be independent from aid, less dependent, and it will be limited to perhaps emergency humanitarian assistance. Africans are increasingly already playing a role in mobilizing resources for its own development. The aggregate capital mobilization in Africa today, when we look at foreign direct investment, sovereign bonds, remittances, equals about $225 billion. These are some trends that can give us some hope. Now, what I've painted, I know most of you know the region. You're probably saying this is a pipe dream. I believe that it's fully in the realms of possibility. The long-term indicators point to this as an eventual possibility. But note that I didn't paint this picture for the Africa of 2020 or 2025. And I think this is what a lot of people miss, that Africa's journey to prosperity will take time. Progress is uneven, there'll be setbacks, there'll be disappointments, and it hinges on a range of factors, many of which are in human control, some are not. Nevertheless, it's really critical that when we talk about Africa's progress, when we work on policy initiatives, we put it in the context of an achievable time frame. And I think Western governments have consistently set time frames that were unrealistic. I mean, it's good to set a goal like the Millennium Development Goals. They were supposed to be met by next year, all of them. But this was never really possible. And when we worked on the African Growth and Opportunity Act, I remember members of Congress telling us, Ambassador Price, don't come back. And they only gave us 5 years. And we've been coming back, and thank God for President Bush, who expanded AGOA and increased it, because we were not going to get our goals achieved in such a short period of time. But I can just say that Africa's exports to the U.S. have increased almost fourfold since 2000. 1.3 million jobs have been created in Africa as a result of a very modest initiative. We said a lot about Ebola, but let me just say that whether you believe that Africa's rising, falling, or both, I believe that the continent is still on the road to success, and with each supposed failure, the deeply entrenched meme that Africa's destined to always be poor and dependent on wealthier nations, I just don't believe that. And in spite of all the, you know, progress that the continent has made, I just noticed that when something happens in one part of Africa, the reputation of the whole continent is impacted, similar to what we were talking about with Ebola. But when something good happens, it's usually seen as an aberration. So I don't know why it doesn't work equally. But, you know, the Ebola crisis is a good example, and I'm not going to say much about that. But, you know, Ebola really is a, in my view, and I think I share in a doctor before, it's a global issue. Because if we don't put out that fire, it can become much, much worse. And a recent assessment of the international spreading risk of the latest Ebola outbreak phase said that based on international travel statistics, the UK, Belgium, France, the US, and Germany all have a higher risk of importing Ebola than either South Africa or Kenya. And it should also be noted that while we've seen some promise in Nigeria and Senegal, that there is some hope, despite the challenge, that with a global response, with strong interventions, with stronger health systems, that this is something that is not a challenge that's not insurmountable. But one compelling lesson from Ebola that I would say that Africa can no longer exist in isolation and can't be quarantined. I just so agree with Secretary Leavitt when he said that the world is as strong as its weakest link. I was just saying, I wish President Obama had appointed him as the czar for Ebola when I heard your former governor speak at the lunch. So I believe that more than ever, Africa's at the tipping point, and the very critical, the role that the U.S. plays is critical in not only influencing the future of Africa, but also our future as a global leader in America. And what my experience has taught me is that the real driver of democracy and political process is broad-based prosperity and economic self-determination. It's not forcible regime change or workshops run by aid organizations. I don't believe that democracy can be imposed, it can be embraced. That's why I'm a strong proponent of the kind of soft power that we talked about today.
That's Rosa Whitaker, CEO and president of the Whitaker Group, a Washington, D.C.-based consultancy specializing in trade and investment in Africa. Well, you've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website and follow this program on Twitter at @KCPWHinckley. And join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.